sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. I'm joined today on the show by Shahid Buttar to discuss civil liberties post 9/11. Shahid Buttar is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee and leads the campaign to defend our civil liberties, constitutional rights, and rule of law principles threatened within the United States by law enforcement and intelligence agencies. He is a constitutional lawyer, grassroots organizer, independent columnist, musician, and poet. Shahid's comments have been featured by news outlets, including The Washington Post, The New York Times, USA Today, CNN, Al Jazeera, Fox News, Agence France-Presse, Huffington Post, Truth Out, Democracy Now!, and many others, including dozens of radio stations around the country. He frequently addresses public audiences such as elected bodies, colleges, and law schools, including Stanford, UC Berkeley, UCLA, the University of Chicago, the University of Texas at Austin, and Georgetown. In addition to his work leading the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Shahid also serves on the advisory bodies of the Rights Working Group, the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedoms, the National Campaign to Restore Civil Rights, and South Asian Americans Leading Together. Shahid Buttar, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You work for the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in Washington, D.C., and 9/11 has been used to justify the attack on our civil liberties. And I'm just wondering if you could tell us about the Patriot Act and where we're at with it today.
Well, so the Patriot Act was a power grab, basically, by the executive branch using 9/11 as a pretext, essentially, to escalate the government's powers to investigate, monitor, and essentially surveil law-abiding Americans. It was, according to its authors, the authors of the Patriot Act say that what they learned from the Snowden disclosures is that their signature legislative achievement was co-opted to do even more than they meant to give the government the power to do, namely by not only giving it a very robust search and monitoring authority, but then applying it pervasively to the entire country as a whole. And so not only is the Patriot Act a travesty that's been not meaningfully curtailed in the 12 years that it's been operational, but what we learned from the Snowden leaks is that a whole range of further things beyond even what the Patriot Act contemplated have also been conducted and remain ongoing, continuing programs violating the Fourth and First Amendment rights of law-abiding Americans en masse. And it's a perfect example of why the Bill of Rights was written in the first place. It's a perfect example of why we need courts. It's an equally disturbing example of why the courts aren't doing their job, nor Congress, and the rights of we the people of the United States are basically being wantonly abused by our government.
And has the Patriot Act been revised or any parts of it been repealed?
It certainly has not been repealed. In fact, the latest, in the wake of the Snowden disclosures over the last year, there has been a very robust congressional debate over a variety of reform proposals, the most recent of which, the USA Freedom Act, has passed the House of Representatives. The disappointing reflection here is that while the act, as it was originally written, promised at least some modicum of reform, not enough by a long shot, but particularly with respect to the telephony metadata program, 215 of the Patriot Act, it did offer some meaningful restrictions. And what happened, what emerged from the legislative sausage making in the congressional process, bore very little resemblance to what began. And even though the original version of the bill passed the House Judiciary Committee unanimously, even though it quite surprisingly passed the House Intelligence Committee, what then was voted on by the House was a completely different bill engineered by the White House, the Democratic White House, and the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives. And I do think, for what it's worth, that Eric Cantor, the Republican majority leader, his participation in the closed-door secret negotiations that killed the USA Freedom Act and gave the NSA a get-out-of-jail-free card, I think his participation in those negotiations is a big part of the reason why he's not coming back to Washington in the fall.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere that his opponent, David Brott, actually made a focus of protecting our civil liberties as part of his campaign.
That's exactly right. Yeah, David Brott has been apparently outspoken not only about the NSA surveillance program, but also the NDAA and indefinite detention, which is a whole other policy area where the Obama administration, despite pledging to reverse the Bush legacy back in 2008, has doubled down and entrenched it at essentially every opportunity. In fact, I have a song out now, and there's a verse to exactly that effect. You know, Bush signed a secret presidential decree talking about the NSA's program. Obama talks a big game, but presidentially did everything he could to entrench the Bush legacy, a complex composed of military industry. Eisenhower, 60 years before, anticipated it would be rising in the wings for generations, growing a crisis in democracy, sowing the future's at stake. You can start by knowing it's the agencies against the Constitution, and it goes on from there.
Where can someone listen to your song?
It's on YouTube. If you just Google NSA versus USA, or if you go to my website, shahidbhutar.com/NSA versus USA. And I would note that there's also a full set of the annotated lyrics. So it's a public education tool. If you're interested in learning more about the history of government surveillance, you might treat that as something of a primer. That's exactly what the song aims to be for a dance floor, essentially.
I was also interested in a little bit about the Military Commissions Act, the NDAA Act, and the indefinite detention, torture. And isn't under one of those, can't the president also actually kill an American citizen if he thinks they're connected to terrorism?
Separate powers. So, but yeah, there's a whole bunch of things sort of lumped in what you spelled out here there. So I'd separate it into three distinct strands. There's a detention authority, and I'll tell a story there. There's torture, I'll tell a story there. And then there's arbitrary assassination, I'll tell a story there. All of them derive from different sources. But the common thread among them is secrecy, lawlessness, and continuity from the Bush administration and escalation through the Obama administration, with torture being the sole exception. But even there, well, let's just get into it. Detention. The Obama administration, to its credit, has at least tried to close facility at Guantanamo Bay. You might read the prisoner swap, the Bergdahl prisoner swap, as an attempt to begin doing that, emptying the last remaining people from Gitmo, who are especially, to this point, have been hard to repatriate. He's been stymied both by Congress and also by his own political reluctance. The president has gotten beaten up a lot on Guantanamo and, quite frankly, not made a lot of headway. I think it's one of the reasons, quite frankly, that he's been so much like the Bush administration and Dick Cheney on surveillance, is taking the heat on the attempts to do the right thing on detention, made the administration much less bold and ultimately actively co-opted on surveillance. So suffice it to say, the MCA, you know, the detention arena has only gotten worse since then. The National Defense Authorization Act, 2012, the NDAA, it passes every year. It's the act that gives the Pentagon the power to spend money. But in 2012, for the first time, it included provisions that could be used to detain Americans indefinitely without trial. It should evoke shades of the Japanese-American internment in World War II, because it's basically that statutory authority. And the Japanese-American community has been very outspoken about this not being okay. In fact, the state of California, pressed largely by the Japanese, was mostly a Japanese-American peace and justice and libertarian coalition across the state, pushed the state legislature to enact and got signed into law a measure that would affirmatively ensure that at least California agencies will not comply with federal orders to detain anyone under that power. And to his credit, the president has said he won't use that section to detain people. But, you know, on several occasions, most recently, just this month, in fact, it might have been May now, an amendment to the next Defense Authorization Act that would have repealed these detention provisions was rejected by essentially a 20-vote margin in the House, which is to say due process in the United States today hangs by a thread. And on the basis of accusation alone, without evidence, without trial, without even the declaration of a charge, someone can be detained without an opportunity to prove their innocence. That is a very dangerous power to exist in a country that claims to lead the free world. You lay on top of that the pervasive surveillance that Edward Snowden revealed, predicated on the Patriot Act, as well as the 2008 FISA Amendments Act. And you lay on top of that torture with impunity, getting to the last of the questions that you raised, you know, all of the ingredients for anything from authoritarianism to even mass atrocity. You know, the ingredients are in place, and it would take very little more than flipping the switch. And once that blender starts turning, we will all get caught up in the blades. There's really nothing anyone can do to stop it once it's activated. And so the pieces are in place. It is a very disturbing time if you look at executive power through that lens. On torture, a couple things to say on torture. The first is that, to his credit, President Obama has renounced the use of torture as an instrument of enhanced interrogation. That is a good thing, full stop. However, torture continues under the Obama administration, particularly through the force-feeding regime at Guantanamo Bay, to force someone who is aiming to essentially starve themselves to death to avoid the conditions of their confinement, forcing them to eat through a method that is brutal, painful, and also in how it's practiced, not particularly sanitary, and moreover, a reflection of human experimentation, because that's one of the things, you know, the force feedings are monitored and recorded and adapted, which is to say they are examples of experiments which are ethically prohibited on human beings, and with very good reason. It is absolutely inhumane and continues under the Obama administration. So torture is very much a live issue. The other thing to note on torture is that no one has ever been held accountable for it since 9/11 in the United States. Despite the Nuremberg trials and the clear precedent that taking orders is not a defense, that national security is not a defense, that it doesn't matter who told you to do what. If you violate human rights, you are going to prison, period. That we fought a world war to establish that principle, we have renounced it in a time of relative peace, and it wasn't the Bush administration that did that. The Bush administration committed torture. That was bad. It is the Obama administration that said it was okay, and I think that's worse.
And why do you think that is? I mean, why do you think even our Congress is doing nothing about that, or the courts? Why is there a breakdown in the checks and balances?
Because if people started going to jail, there would be no telling where to stop. And the culpability in torture stretches across both of the major corporate political parties. It ensnares at least the intelligence committees in both houses of Congress. It would take down half of the national security establishment. And the fact of the matter is that all of those people, under international legal principles, are in fact criminals, but they still have positions of power and prestige. And now, it's interesting especially to contrast this with the phenomenon of mass incarceration, which might seem separate, but it goes like this. There are 2.5 million people in America who were denied freedom by the state, in many cases for offenses that shouldn't be criminal in the first place, right? That that don't have any third-party impacts, that don't affect anyone else, criminal behavior that affects only oneself. Of those 2.5 million people, how many of them are the powerful officials who are guilty on the public record of violating our species' most fundamental and widely shared commitments? Not a single one. And it's striking that we jail people for meaningless actions, the trivial crimes, and we look the other way and heap power and prestige on people guilty of committing grievous offenses.
Atrocities.
That's right. And there's one other thing on torture that I feel like often gets overlooked in the debate, if I may.
Certainly.
People think about torture, and there's a debate about whether or not it gains useful intelligence. And it's clear that it doesn't. It's clear that it enrages our enemies, and it's clear that it serves them by giving them a narrative to facilitate their recruitment efforts. All that is well established. There's another angle, though, that people forget, which is that torture isn't necessarily aimed to get intelligence. The purpose of torture, the value that it serves to an set of institutions that use it, is that it legitimates a surrounding set of abuses. Because when you torture people, everyone is guilty. You don't have acquittals when there is torture, because people will say anything to stop being tortured. Torture is a way to insulate a system from accountability by denying the public sympathetic characters. You don't have just accused terrorists anymore. If you can detain people and not torture them, you have accused terrorists. If you can torture them, they're all terrorists.
So their confession then confirms that what we're doing is right.
Right. Torture is the lock on the coffin of democracy. You could say the same thing, quite frankly, about surveillance, because it also chills people into not ever developing critical thought. So we have multiple locks, unfortunately. I heard a very jarring quote at a conference this week, the Computers, Freedom, and Privacy Conference, from Julian Assange. I guess it was the third-party quote of him from some time ago, and he said that we are the last free generation, and we probably have 10 years left.
Wow.
It's a jarring thing to think about, but I do think that the controversy emerging from the Snowden leaks, like, this is the time to shrug off the yoke of the national security state, and it can certainly be done.
And let's talk about that.
What can people do to throw off this yoke of surveillance state?
One of the things about the song I'm most proud about in the video is that it's addressed with specificity there. I'll throw you some words and I'll connect them. So the first is to connect. The next is to organize, to mobilize, and to resist. And that can look like different ways, and the video depicts a whole bunch of them. One thing, last December, on December 15th, Bill of Rights Day, a group of about seven of us went outside the NSA headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland, and we, outside highway overpass by the NSA's national headquarters, dropped a 20-foot-tall banner reading, Save America, Close the NSA. And some number of thousands of people driving by the NSA's headquarters that day saw that. And that's the kind of thing that any group of seven people can do anywhere.
Yeah, I think all those kinds of activities are good, but here's my concern with that is that it doesn't seem like Congress on either side of the aisle is working for us. They're doing whatever they're told to do, it seems like to me. And it's the federal government, the executive branch, doesn't seem to care. It's almost like there's, you know, other people calling the shots, perhaps a shadow government of some sort. So I'm just wondering, aside from doing those things, where can we go to make them really count?
So there's a couple different responses to that. The first is that with respect to what members of Congress internalize, you're absolutely right that they are essentially bought and paid for, but look at the experience of Eric Cantor.
Uh-huh.
It provides a very different signal to members of Congress who might otherwise be very complicit in the offenses of the national security state, because one of the things I think members of Congress might internalize if they look at that situation very carefully is that you serve the interests of the national security state at your own electoral peril, because we the people see what is happening and we have had enough. And I do think that it's worth noting also that Virginia has an open primary, which is to say that the votes in that primary could include disaffected Democrats voting also to influence the Republican electoral primary. So it reflects a transpartisan rejection of executive fiat and the idea that members of Congress should be independent. That's one piece. Now, there's another way to look at this, though. We might think that repealing the surveillance state is simply a policy matter. There is a bill, for instance, called the Surveillance State Repeal Act, which not enough members of Congress are on. And if your listeners needed any discrete thing when you were asking me how to translate grassroots disaffection into institutional power and influence, the number one thing people could do is to pick up the phone, call their member of Congress and say, will you sponsor the Surveillance State Repeal Act? Make clear your constituent, get the letter that they send you, and then if you want, connect with us and we'll figure out how to coordinate with people doing the same thing in other places. It's the bill that would repeal the Patriot Act. It would repeal the 2008 FISA amendments. It would roll back the post-9/11 clock on surveillance. It would take us back to September 10th, and it would force the agencies to justify any new powers from a pre-9/11 baseline. And it is worth noting that no agency can do that, because we know that to whatever extent, even the official narrative about 9/11 concedes that it was not a collection failure. It was a failure to connect dots, which is to say all of the collection powers that the agencies have gained over the last 14 years respond to a problem that doesn't exist even under the official narrative.
So it's called the Surveillance State Repeal Act.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Currently sponsored by Representative Rush Holt, Democrat from New Jersey, and most of the members of Congress who have talked a big game about privacy have failed to embrace this very meaningful alternative to do something to actively defend it. There's a broader point, though, I want to make, and this is this. If we might think that it's a matter of policy, and if Congress adopted that policy, that would certainly be a big step forward, right?
Yes, definitely.
If it adopts the USA Freedom Act, it's sort of like a shuffling of one foot forward. If even that, quite frankly, his bill was co-opted so badly in the House, it might not even be useful at all. It's potentially counterproductive, as it were, which is to say it's not the USA Freedom Act. It could be like Patriot 3. But the point of this is that it's more than a policy fight. This is a cultural battle. And it goes like this. We have three competing sets of institutions, constitutionally, executive, judicial, and legislative, meant to balance each other, as well as three branches, the federal, state, and local. So there's a matrix of government institutions. They're meant to check and balance each other, but they have come to align because the state and local executives, the police departments, the sheriff's departments, the highway patrols, they align and work with, through the fusion centers and other mechanisms, the federal law enforcement agencies, the federal executive, which the federal legislative branch, Congress, has worked actively to empower at every turn by enacting, for instance, the Patriot Act, or the Military Commissions Act, or the 2008 FISA amendments. So Congress has been supine to the executive that has grown and grown, metastasized across the federal, state, and local governments. The judiciary is checked out. The courts haven't meaningfully restrained executive power, at least in the surveillance arena, at all in a generation. And even the few cases where they have, like the Jones case, I mean, that's a legal arcana, but that's not actually a privacy case. It's a property case, yada, yada. The point is, the courts aren't doing their jobs either. So if the courts aren't doing their jobs and Congress isn't doing its job, whether it's bought and paid for by the military-industrial complex or because they're so disempowered by the executive secrecy that they don't even know what they're legislating. And we know at least that that is true. If Congress can't do it and the courts don't do it, how do you do it? So the question then becomes, what is the parallel struggle? We can't look to policy fights to give us examples. The analogous instance to look towards for inspiration are democracy struggles to displace authoritarian governments in other countries. Think about like the transition from the Warsaw Pact countries to the post-communist era. You know, how did that happen? It was as much rock and roll and blue jeans as it was in an institutional process, right? So the culture jamming stuff is critical. It is all about escalating the level of dissent and making it pervasive and ubiquitous. And that only happens in groups of five and six. Groups of 60,000 people working for 6 months to come together for a day and march through the streets of the city, like if you're lucky. But if those 60,000 people are active in 10,000 units of six doing one thing a week, whether it's standing on a street corner with a sign or doing a light brigade action or doing a banner drop or doing a speak out in a public park, that stuff matters. That stuff adds up. And that stuff, especially when it's coordinated and focused, is inexorable. And we have to take advantage of the spheres that we have control over. And we don't have control over Congress. We don't have control over courts, but we have control over the culture. That's where we assert influence. And I think that the only way to delegitimate a set of institutions that are entrenched is to do it through that kind of action. I mean, that's how perestroika and glasnost happened. That's how that transition happened. In most countries, the transition from authoritarian rule, peaceably at least, to another form, that's how it happened.
Yeah, that's interesting because I think most Americans are pretty unhappy with where we're at in a lot of ways, not just the civil liberties, but they don't know what to do.
Well, and I think that was part of the theory with the Occupy movement. And we saw with the same way, for instance, that the rise of the NSA's program represented the death of the Fourth Amendment, the suppression of the Occupy movement by force, coordinated by the FBI and including local police departments, that represented the end of the freedom to assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. Like, we have lost serially different parts of the Bill of Rights, in fact, regardless of whether any court has admitted it. As a matter of fact, we don't have the right to assemble. We don't have the right to be free from unreasonable searches. We don't have due process. Those are not rights we actually have anymore in the United States.
And the loss of those has been based on this war on terror, the fear of terrorists. And there was an article on your website, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee website, in the past few weeks. It was talking about a study that's come out that says domestic terror prosecutions are contrived. And the study's called Inventing Terrorists, the Lawfare of Preventive Prosecution. And here's what they say in their introduction, and I just wonder if you would comment on it. The war on terror has been largely a charade designed to make the American public believe that a terrorist army is loose in the U.S., when the truth is that most of the people convicted of terrorism-related crimes posed no danger to the U.S. and were entrapped by a preventive strategy known as preemptive prosecution.
That's exactly right. You know, I'll tell you an example from Newburgh, New York. This is a town, well, you know, your listeners probably know it. It's not far outside the city, just up the Hudson Valley. And four men, I believe all of them African-American, at least three of them, in 2010 or maybe 2011, it might have even been 2009 now that I think about it, were indicted and ultimately convicted of a plot to bomb a synagogue. These individuals included one schizophrenic, at least one heroin addict, and two people who'd been in and out of jail their whole lives. The judge at sentencing said, in no uncertain terms, that she didn't believe that they were capable of doing anything. They couldn't get their way out of a paper bag, let alone come up with the plot, which they were accused of developing, which included basically an FBI agent bribing each of them with $50,000 to participate in the plot that the FBI agent proposed. Yeah. That's not actually countering terrorism. I wrote an article for the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU examining what this means. You know, the focus on illusory cases undermines then the data mining mosaic theory enterprise in which the counterterrorism establishment is also engaged, right? The theory goes, if you can predict precursors or identify precursors of violence, then you can predictively keep people from deploying their plans because you'll be able to identify those behaviors that are, you know, correlated with subsequent violence. And there's a whole data mining enterprise going into that. But if you pollute the pool of data with fake cases, cases of people like Siraj Mateen in New York City, you know, a mentally disabled young man who a teenager with the mental sophistication of an 8-year-old is basically brainwashed by an NYPD agent into saying something very unfortunate that lands him a 25-year terrorism sentence. And don't forget, this one piece that I think people always forget is the accused terrorist. 30% of the terrorists in the Federal Communications Management Units in the CMUs are white environmentalists from the Pacific Northwest whose worst crimes would be described as environmentally motivated arson or vandalism, which is now terrorism, supposedly, under the new expanded definition.
So why do this? Why have these FBI entrapments, they're fake, and then take away our civil liberties based on that? What's the agenda here? Why are they doing this?
The report comes to a conclusion. I mean, in my mind, it's the best we could do here as a hypothesis, but the shoe certainly fits, and that is to make the case for the continued expansion of the intelligence agency's powers and budgets. They have made that case pretty effectively because despite the serial failure, I think it bears recollection that Al-Qaeda would not exist were it not for the CIA's intervention in South Asia in the 1980s, right? So we're talking about intelligence agencies that create the future threats and then respond by escalating the restrictions on our liberties. Think, for instance, about Gary Webb's work. He was the reporter at the San Jose Mercury News who wrote the book Dark Alliance. It basically uncovers the CIA's participation in running cocaine into ghettos around the city in order to fund the Contra revolution in Nicaragua. The Iran-Contra scandal had a domestic face, and that was the importation of cocaine, which then brought with it stronger weapons, which was used as a pretext to militarize the police. So the CIA is responsible both for creating Al-Qaeda, which has been used to justify the pervasive surveillance state, and it was responsible for engineering the fights in U.S. cities that was the pretext to militarize the police. So, you know, the intelligence agencies, to the extent their mission is to defend American interests, have done anything but that.
Well, Shahid, we're almost out of time. And again, your website is the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
B-O-R-D-C, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, B-O-R-D-C.org.
And your own personal website where your song can be found is?
ShahidBhutar.com. And you can also find the music video for NSA versus USA on YouTube.
And Shahid is spelled S-H-A-H-I-D, and Bhutar is B-U-T-T-A-R. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the listeners before we have to pause today?
Just do not lose hope and do not lose sight of the fact that the battles we confront as our generation are no less than holding the line on principles that have served humanity for millennia. The due process has stood for 800 years, and we cannot let these principles die on our watch. And it is an absolute leviathan that we confront, but we have overcome worse fights before. Overcoming and unwinding slavery in the 19th century was no harder than defeating the military-industrial complex today. And we have overcome worse foes in the past, and we will do so as a people again.
And on your website, the BORDC.org, do you have information there on how people can get involved, what they can do?
Absolutely, yeah. We have grassroots toolkits. We invite anybody to reach out to our organizing team at organizing@BORDC.org. We exist to support your activism, and we would love to hear from any of your listeners who are interested in raising their voices to challenge the national security agencies and law enforcement agencies.
Shahid Bhutar, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks so much. Yeah. Keep up the good work.
And again, that was an interview with Shahid Bhutar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. I'd also like to point out that the U.S. isn't the only country using 9/11 and the threat of terrorism, real or imagined, to curtail civil liberties. Many countries around the world are doing the same. But only you can protect the U.S. Constitution, which is clearly threatened. So please get involved. If not you, then who? This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.